once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English then.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another, to us, exciting and sometimes hilarious episode of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
The fact that we find it hilarious is indicative of our geekiness, because everyone else is going, that was very dry. I don't know
just
if that
show,
was...
Just to show, Jake just got through giving me, this is Jeff, a piece of information that I thought was, I personally think, is absolutely fascinating.
Oh, yes, fascinating.
And I don't know that anyone else in the world really cares about it, but I'm going to say it anyway, and that's it. We're looking for patterns and things and the way things spin and the way things go. And he noted that if you look on the coins printed in the United States, the president always faces in the same direction, which is an indication of some kind of a pattern. Except for the penny.
It faces the other direction, which is maybe a trend is starting here. Maybe
it could
be a
reversal.
See, we do this because causation and correlation are so foreign from each other most of the time, and people try to find patterns in things. They work really hard to find patterns in things because that's what we do as humans.
Now, are the presidents facing to the right or the left?
They are facing to the left, Abraham Lincoln is facing to the right.
So,
and he's made of copper.
Probably, not really. It used to be made of copper, but copper became too valuable.
There's some zinc in there.
Yeah,
zinc in
a lot
the
of zinc. In other words, if Ronald Reagan ever gets a coin, he'll probably be facing to the right.
Well, it just depends on a lot of things there, because, you know, on the dime, we've got a more recent president than most of the others, and he is also facing to the left.
Well, that would make sense. That's Kennedy, right?
Truman or FDR?
Somebody. Who's on the dime,
March
anyway?
Of Dimes was FDR, so...
Anyway, the issue, this would be an interesting thing. We could study this and follow this over an extended period of time to determine as new presidents gradually appear on coins over long periods of time.
Yeah, it's FDR, Franklin Delano.
Well, he would be facing to the left.
Of course.
That
it's
makes
a
sense.
A left-leaning person.
Right. And you don't have Herbert Hoover on a coin. He would be facing to the right. So Abraham Lincoln, who was a Republican.
Right. He was facing to the right. But see, you've got George Washington, who was
neither
of those. See, we didn't have those parties at the time.
Right.
He was wearing a wig, but he wasn't one.
So he's facing to the left as well?
He is facing to the left on the quarter, mm-hmm. Yes.
That's a fascinating thing. We need to track this over a very long period of time see.
I laugh about this because it has as much bearing as how far up the shore one wave goes rather than another, or it has as much bearing as who won the Super Bowl in a given year and what the market does.
Who did win the Super Bowl this year?
I haven't a clue. I think it was the Bulls. I think they won last year.
But not the Bears.
Not the Bears. No,
right.
I don't think the Bears won this year.
Okay, so it's the Bulls versus the Bears.
In Chicago, yes.
Right.
That's for the World Series, I think. Right. That's not for the Super Bowl. Something like that.
The World Bowl.
Yeah.
Okay. But actually, it's in New York that they play.
Yeah, so for us, this is a hilarious conversation.
They
for
play
other
on
people,
Wall Street.
They're like, they're talking about coins.
They make
and
no sense at all.
Sports
but anyway,
teams that aren't even in the same
You're welcome to
sport.
Return us to reality. By calling 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
I mentioned earlier there's another little trend in the economy. We like watching little trends in the economy,
mm-hmm.
And that
true
is
trends, not fake ones.
If we and it's one of those to me it's a strong confirmation of what else is going on. But what else is there about it? Anyway, that's an inside deal.
Yes,
the Walmart's earnings are up, but they're not up as much as Wall Street thought.
Expected.
And I think Wall Street and Walmart ought to be working together.
They should be. There should be. Walmart should be on Wall Street.
You
there should
it.
Be a mart there just for that could call that Walmart.
But the point is that if you go up the scale in retail outlets, you find out that the further up the economic scale
the further the
their
profits
target
go
is,
up.
The better their profitability is. And then
that's a reversal from what was going on during the recession.
Right. And you turn around and look at what's going on according to the Commerce Department, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and the Labor Department in the labor market, and you find out precisely the same thing is going on.
Upper end jobs are picking up faster than lower end jobs.
We're actually having a job shortage of educated, skilled workers in the United States.
All you have to do, just as a minor point, if you're a programmer, it doesn't matter what you program in, if you are a programmer and you need a job, whisper it. Just make a little whisper somewhere in a non-crowded area, and you'll get three offers in the next 2 minutes.
You know, when on I-35 there are billboards up advertising for programmers,
right,
that there's a serious shortage of skilled workers.
Nurses, doctors, programmers, engineers,
right,
architects. You go down the list of people, and when I say architect, this is as a symbol of something. Architects are in demand right now.
Isn't that amazing?
When the real estate market is in a massive slowdown, or it maybe is picking back up. But if you look at the high-end, high-skilled, where people actually have to work hard to get the designation to make the decisions, those jobs are in high demand.
But lawyers...
Lawyers
have high levels of unemployment. There's something to be said for that. But anyway, we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with a personal wealth coach. Go ahead. Hello?
Hello?
There. Yes. Hello?
Still there?
Yes, we are here. Are you there?
Yes.
Good.
This is Robert.
Hello, Robert.
I was just going to call you y'all. Hello. I was going to give you all a heads up, and you probably already heard this. Wall Street Journal, but the IRS is fixing to cause some waves in the exempt bond market as they go through and examine some of these tax-exempt bond issues
and
sale facilities and reclassify those as private activity bond instead of exempt bonds.
Yes.
Correct. Correct.
That's gonna roil your exempt bond market, I believe.
We've been talking about this for about 2.5 years.
Incidentally, we have a quantitative analysis program that we've written that looks at various asset classes and makes recommendations. And I was really shocked initially to see that when I ran thank you for calling.
Yes, that was a great call.
When I ran the analysis that came out, we just now we've gotten it up and functioning from the July data, and it recommended putting a lot of money in municipal bonds. So I went back and looked to see what the heck is going on there. And what
somebody's been cooking the books.
No, it looks at the yield to maturity on municipal bonds, and the yield to maturity, it has in fact, with the bond market sell-off, risen dramatically, which is why I see articles saying there's a great buying opportunity in bonds. But
one of the problems is that we have a big uncertainty there.
Well, here's the issue. The higher the interest rate on something like a municipal bond,
the higher the risk.
The market is effectively saying, right, that's what he said. I mean, the market effectively is saying is there's a high risk to these things.
A big one.
And yet the typical, I don't know if typical is the right word, but many investors will flock to the higher interest rate because they get sold the higher coupon on, let's just say, a new municipal bond. And they really don't get it that if a tax-exempt bond that theoretically is, quote, safe, end quote, is paying a higher interest rate than
a corporate bond.
Corporate bond of like rating or a treasury bond, that means there is a higher risk.
Much higher risk.
Of default.
Much higher risk because it should be paying a much lower rate than a corporate bond because you don't have to pay taxes on it. So that's part of the reason why municipalities can get away with a lower interest rate is because you don't pay the taxes on the thing. If they're paying a higher rate than an equivalent U.S. Treasury or an equivalent corporate bond, it means that not only did they have to meet the difference between the lower rate with the taxes, then they went up above that. That risk, the caller was just summed it up very nicely. We've got dangers of default in municipalities that, you know, even ones with the backing of the taxpayer they're being defaulted on in Detroit. They're being defaulted on in several other municipalities, which means that the fundamental bedrock, the layer that is guarding all of municipal municipal securities, the thing that reaches from one shore to the other in the United States is cracked. We have a problem.
And there's a fundamental reason for that.
And then you have these exempt securities, tax-exempt securities, that these there's lots of problems there. If you're not going to use them for the purpose that they were put out there for, they may not be tax-exempt, in which case, not only does the municipality have to pay, but the people that own the bonds have to pay.
There's a very fundamental thing occurred in the state of Michigan that actually has not occurred, and you're going to think this is a little strange, I did a little research on it, as far as I can tell, since the 1830s. From what we actually had in the 1830s is states defaulting on their municipal bonds, if you will.
Right.
And coming forward from there, there has been an understood agreement that if there is a major general revenue bond of a municipality in a state, that the state will step in if that bond appears to be headed for default. It's just, there's no law. That's one of the interesting things. I thought there was a law somewhere.
Nope.
And
California's decided not to do that. They went the opposite direction.
Right,
let the municipalities fail rather than the state government.
And we saw it happen in California. Well, California is weird and different, so nobody thinking about it. Well, now
California.
It's happened. Now it's happened in Wisconsin, and
we're talking about.
There's a discussion.
Michigan as well. We're talking about Michigan,
but Illinois is in the same boat. They effectively have said in Illinois that if municipality, you are responsible for your pension fund.
Which is not possible for the municipalities anymore.
And we have the event in Detroit, in essence, may have been bigger. It may have been unique to this moment in time. But it's not a one-off event. And
it's the same bankruptcy that took place with General Motors and with Chrysler.
It is
when the pension fund becomes the largest expense for any entity. When the retirees that are not producing a value to that entity right now are a larger expense than the active duty people, you're going to have problems. That's just the case.
Yeah.
I mean, before General Motors could make a car, before they could do anything, they had to pay their pension fund. They had to pay the health care for their retirees, which meant that every car they made had to be one-third more expensive than it should have been, because one-third of their overhead was based on things that didn't have to do with the creation of an item that people were willing to pay for.
And that's that is one of those things that I think has to be very carefully guarded against.
There are solutions. They already exist. A 401k is better than a fixed pension because it gives the ability for the individual to take responsibility for their own lives, one. And two, the company or the municipality doesn't have to keep funding the thing for the rest of the worker's life until they die.
And there's a little, tiny little piece that comes in here that I looked at with great optimism when I saw it, and then I realized how devastating it would be.
Uh-oh.
One of the prognostications that has come out several times recently in when medical researchers are asked to say what major changes they expect over the next 20 years, they seem to have a consensus that there is a reasonable chance, certainly not a probability, but a reasonable chance that most of the age-related issues will be addressable and addressed 20 years from now. In other words, a person's life expectancy, who's alive and healthy at that point, might easily be extended
dramatically
by many decades. Now, think about for just a moment what that would mean to a defined benefit retirement program.
That's a simple thing here.
Or
think about what that means to China.
But Well, no, it doesn't.
That's no, a bad, mean, bad ding for China.
But the point is, in China, most people don't have medical care of any significance anyway. It's going to be relatively expensive. But the other thing is, I want to say is that also means that companies that issue annuities suddenly go bankrupt.
Yep.
If the life expectancy and life expectancy continues to go up, but and I assume that there would be some peak in it at some point when, okay, we just can't extend life expectancies anymore. But that's the point that the medical researchers are saying probably won't happen. And we may not have them all whipped in 20 years, but they seem to be agreed that based on the science, but not based on some speculative point, but based on the breakthroughs they're making in genetic and understanding genetics and understanding genetically related diseases, that the average life expectancy may continue to crank up. We may easily see, and I'm not kidding here, I think the very high probability of seeing a life expectancy of 120.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does that do to an insurance company who has made a bet by offering by selling lots of annuities, which they're doing like hotcakes right now because it's money they get in, they don't have to pay for the next 30 years. What does that do to an annuity company that's betting on your being dead by 75 or 80 if they suddenly see life expectancies go to 120? And the answer is it means they go bankrupt and don't pay.
Yeah. One of the pieces of science, just to let you know that it's happening all over the place. The reason why people get, or dogs get, or any other animal gets, for that matter, white hair has been defined very clearly. And it's a shock. There's a slight mutation that happens in the cells of the hair follicle that causes hydrogen peroxide to be produced at the core of the hair follicle.
Is that what happened to the top of our heads?
That's it. That's all. No, to us, it was probably had to do with testosterone, but,
oh,
you know,
okay.
Hey. But white hair happens with hydrogen peroxide, which is produced in our bodies all the time. It was just produced at the center of the hair follicle. So we're just bleaching our hair. And there are easy treatments that have already been applied to older mice that work immediately. The hair follicle recovers its color. It's not a dye. It just stops dying itself.
Wait a minute. That's it. My hair follicles died.
Yeah, your hair. But we don't have hair follicles. That's the
issue.
They
died.
We just left.
Stop the dying?
We left them. Yeah, no more dying for it. It's already dead.
Oh.
So, yes. Oh, okay. We dyed our hair clear.
Well, anyway, I know we've wandered completely off the subject now. So, this is still the Personal Wealth Coach. And I am still Jeff McClure. And this guy over here is still
Jake McClure.
And we are still, little disclosure, we are still the principal advising members of an investment advisory firm. And we would love to hear from
you. By the same name, the Personal Wealth Coach.
Well, that's purely not coincidental.
Not at all.
We said that coincidence and causation are different things.
No, we said correlation and causation are different
things. There's a high correlation between the name of that investment advisory firm and Salado and this radio program.
Yes, the correlation and the causation are interrelated in this particular case.
We need to do a study on that.
Just like we are interrelated in this particular case.
We are, as a matter of fact. Telephone numbers in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And you can tell by the fact that I just reached my left hand over and grabbed a mouse.
Yes.
Did you ever think about that?
You're just grabbing a mouse right there, on the sitting on the desk. It's
but
amazing.
The Personal Wealth Coach is about to take a pause. Oh.
To play some commercials.
So you grabbed a mouse and a pause
and all
and
of this.
We're going to create some pause, yes. And we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if you'll check out your calendar, if today is Saturday, August 17th, we're taking telephone calls at 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
You almost messed up there.
I almost said the wrong number.
You did.
I was going to say
the
three.
Wrong number. Wrong, yes. And we were talking about lots of stuff before.
I wanted to talk about something specific to a lot of portfolios right now. We've been talking about very generalized stuff, but I get asked this
stuff.
yeah, stuff. It's a technical term. But I get asked this generally once a week, sometimes a little bit rarer than that, the question of whether or not someone should take a loan from their 401k or retirement plan to pay for expenses. And I have a pretty drastic response to that generally, which is to say, no! Most people have that have large 401ks that are talking about taking a loan from it recognize that they haven't paid taxes on the money that goes into that 401k. And when they take the loan out, they're not going to pay taxes on that either. So it seems like a pretty good deal. And the loan on the 401k is generally very low interest, and you're being charged by yourself. So you're going to pay that interest back to yourself. So why is this a bad thing? And the answer is a little bit weird in that you didn't pay taxes to put that money in your 401k. You haven't paid taxes on it yet. You take the money out as a loan. You still haven't paid taxes on it. It's great. You get to pay that money out. Now you pay that loan back. Where did you get that money? You got that money from money you've paid taxes on. So now you swapped out money you haven't paid taxes on with money you have paid taxes on. You've already paid money on taxes on that money. You put it back in there. And now when your retirement comes around, you pull that money out, and guess what?
You have dramatically increased your expense ratio.
Yes, you get to pay taxes again.
And that is, it's expenses are important.
Very, very important.
And they're not the only thing.
No.
But and some people have tried to make it sound like they are the only thing. It's certainly not true.
If you don't have a good return, but you have no expenses.
Yeah, I've been in a massive debate recently in a blog that only
people geeky in our economists and investment people look at.
And it has to do with the fact that there's some people on the other end of the blog who absolutely insist that indexing is and low cost indexing is the absolute only way to go, and they insist again and again and again. For example, they have had repeated to me so many times, 85% the S&P 500 or the total market index or whatever you want to look at outperforms 85% of the mutual funds, and I have just gone back to them again and again and again.
It's a very simple way to answer that.
I'd show a Morningstar's category. And where is the S&P 500 index in that? And matter of fact, I actually show them the least expensive S&P 500 index mutual fund in there. Right now, for example, the I think the total market index is in like the 65th percentile for 15 years. And what that means is 64% of the mutual funds that have existed, the equity mutual funds with the same objective.
They're trying to do the same thing.
Have outperformed the S&P 500 for that period of time. And
it's a simple people think of this as a very complex thing, but let's just take it back to what is the index? What is the S&P 500? Well, Standard & Poor's puts together a list of 500 companies that are basically put in there based on their size. 500 very large companies put into this index. And the suggestion that somebody using a brain can look at those same 500 companies and the average person that does this for a living can look at these companies and say, this one is profitable and that one is not. I'm going to buy the profitable one and not the not profitable one. The suggestion that they can't do as well as just randomly putting them all together, I think is pretty ludicrous. A professional money manager that is investing in the S&P 500, the average manager very far beats the average, the index.
And it's not a matter of, and that's just not the simple thing. Pure performance isn't the answer anyway. It's what we call risk-adjusted return.
Right.
And in case any of you happen to be geeky that are listening out there.
That's pretty much anybody that's listening to this program right now has got to be geeky.
The argument that I got back in this debate was, well, there's survivorship bias, which means that the mutual funds that failed aren't in the average. Well, in fact, they are in the Morningstar category.
Right, in the Morningstar.
By the way, that
goes the other direction.
When I pointed out that Morningstar categories, they insisted Morningstar categories did not include the failed funds. And I came back and read, actually quoted word for word, copied it, put it into the blog, that it does. Now,
on the other side, the S&P 500 does have a survivorship bias in that people that the companies that are no longer in the S&P 500 get removed and replaced by another company, and there's no change in the performance of the S&P 500
but
when that happens.
Obviously, if you're in a S&P 500 index, you benefit from that. Anyway, let me go on to something else I want to talk about here, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm. Go right ahead.
There is a book out there that I will... And
just one.
And very rarely do I recommend a book I have not thoroughly read, but I have read enough about this book right now. I'm going to order it, and I would go ahead and encourage you to order it if you want to really understand the investing, the professional people who offer investments or investment advice.
What's the name of the book?
It is, let's see, Get Wise to Your Advisor. Okay? It's by a guy named Steve Lockshin. The name of the book, again, is Get Wise to Your Advisor. There is, in his interview with Barron's, he has a quote. I'm going to read it to you. If you have a conflict, you should call yourself a broker. And if you don't have a conflict, you can call yourself an advisor. But lots of people call themselves advisors who are brokers. The consumers are confused as hell.
Well, that makes sense. We've talked about that quite a lot.
Therein, folks, is the issue. And I cannot emphasize this so much. It's amazing to me. I was even talking to a broker the other day who said he is amazed. This is the funny thing. The broker told me he was amazed that people don't ask him a simple question and that they run off and put their money with a brokerage firm, Merrill Lynch, which, by the way, officially disappears this year. I don't know. Bank of America said Merrill Lynch will cease to exist
yes,
this year.
Right.
Edward Jones, whoever.
He whomever.
Said, whomever. He said, nobody ever asked, are you a fiduciary? Do you have an undisclosed conflict of interest when you invest my money? Do you receive benefits that I am not fully informed of and that causes you to choose these investments? He said, nobody ever asked him that. And he said, and of course, this is the issue. He is a broker. I was a broker. Jake was a broker. We understand. We didn't understand very well at the time we were doing it because we were busy trying to make a living by selling stuff. But there's a simple fact. If you look at what brokers sell, they sell a lot more of what pays them a higher commission. And they sell a lot less of what pays them a lower commission. For example...
Oh, that's really amazing stuff that you're saying there.
But I think anybody would do that. And when you pay a higher commission for something, it isn't the company paying the higher amount. It's the investor paying the higher amount. And I think there's a place for brokers. I really do. But that brokers call themselves financial advisors is confusing the issue massively because survey after survey says that the people who invest with a broker assume that the person is acting in their best interest when literally by law they cannot. They must act in the best interest of their employer. It's one of those fascinating things. And, you know, the broker pointed out to me, and I don't know this is true, although I went to the website and looked for it, and I asked a broker from that firm, and he seemed to think it was true too. For instance, Edward Jones is forbidden to sell no-load funds. The brokers are forbidden to sell no-load funds. In other words, they can't. If you come in and say, look, I want a no-load fund, can he offer it to you? No. Why? Well, because his company is in the business of making money, and if it's a no-load fund,
they don't make any money.
They don't make any money. Therefore, there must be charges associated with it. People don't understand that there's always charges. It's a matter of whether you see them or not, and it's a matter of whether they're fully disclosed and reasonable or whether they're undisclosed. Well, I say undisclosed. Read the prospectus carefully prior to investing is the warning you get when you go see a broker. But the book really summarizes the interview, at least, by the author of this book, really, really, really summarized to me the essence of the reason for investing here. If you are a long-term investor, every indication is a long-term investor who is getting expert fiduciary advice will tend to do well. If you're short-term and you're moving in and out and you're jumping around without very, very, very good economic reason for doing so, and you're paying commissions when you do so, even if they're invisible commissions, the odds are vastly against your doing exceptionally well in the market over a long period of time. That's just one of the solid things that appears again and again and again. That's not to say you can't make a profit over a long period of time. It's just that it is hugely more expensive. Jake was talking about the fact that if you take money out of, for example, a 401k or a IRA or whatever, when you remove money from the market, for example, to avoid borrowing money from, let's say, a mortgage company, I routinely advise people not to do that. And there's a reason for that, and it is because if the person removes the money from the market today and we have an average market return, or even actually a below average market return over the next 10 years in your account, then double the amount of money you remove from the market. Because it's 7.2% at a 7.2% rate of return, which is below the long-term stock market average. And when I say long-term, I'm talking about over 100 years. At a 7.2% return, the market doubles every 10 years. It's that simple. A 7.2% rate of return doubles the market every 10 years. You remove money that's invested in the United States stock market, and odds are, there's no certainty here, that if you leave the money out for 10 years because you didn't want to do a mortgage, you have doubled the cost of what you took out. You take out $100,000, you effectively took out $200,000 in 10 years. You've taken out $400,000 20 years from now. You borrow the money, you pay it back over a period of time. Currently, long-term mortgages are at 4.4%. That's tax deductible. So you'd be, you know, you're probably paying 3-point-something percent, which is a little over inflation, but not much. Over that same period of time, and you've got a declining balance in there, and in fact, I know this is going to sound a little strange, what you will pay back over a 30-year period today on a 4.4% mortgage will be about what you borrowed after inflation. Whereas if you take money out of the market because you don't want to go through the drill of getting a mortgage. And by the way, if you can't get a mortgage for a house, odds are you should not be buying it.
Yes, that's if you can't get the mortgage, that's the whole concept. If you can't get the mortgage, why are you buying it to begin with? If the bank didn't think you could pay it back, you probably can't.
So the issue is there's a lot of things that go into successful long-term investing. But number one is the fact that it has to be long-term investing.
Yes.
And it is so hard at this moment in time. Matter of fact, I'm running into people right now. I say running into. We're encountering some friction with people right now who want higher rates of return in a shorter period of time. That is just that kind of greed is just extremely dangerous. And it's one of those. There's a money manager was in the Wall Street Journal, by the way, up at, I think it's Wall Street Journal, Barron, one of the two, up in Dallas, who says he's leaving his clients' money with SAC, which is Cohen's.
Well, yeah, that's interesting that that's going on, because the most recent deadline's coming up soon on when they can pull money out of there. It looks like
it's Cohen's hedge fund.
Yeah, the one that the guy, that the company itself has been charged with fraud. Cohen has been charged with criminal and civil charges.
No, he hasn't.
The indictment is put out there for him.
Not for him. It's for the company. He has not been charged with anything.
Oh, no. He's correct. He's the
his company
disciplinary
is,
hearing to remove him from the financial industry.
Right, but that's not a criminal charge.
No.
And by the way, the SEC's suit will seize all the money in his fund. And there's a money manager in Dallas is in the Wall Street Journal saying that he's decided to leave his money with Cohen that he's managing for his clients. Greed rears its ugly head again.
Yeah. Yeah. Now I'm going to change the subject if you don't mind. There's a subject that is near and dear to my heart and probably not dear or near to most anybody else's, although I do occasionally get some questions about it. Federal Reserve Chairman, is being...
Janet?
Janet Yellen is up there. Hopefully she will be the choice.
She's my man. Do you love that? She's my man.
Barack Obama has a choice, and according to the news media, which doesn't necessarily get its facts straight most of the time, the choice is between Lawrence Summers and Janet Yellen. And most of you have heard of Lawrence Summers, even if it's just in passing. Larry Summers was the Secretary of Treasury under Bill Clinton. He is very political. His motivation is extremely political. He comes out and talks about politics as quite often in the past decade. He's been out talking about politics. And something that is very clear, and it's been known to the political world for quite some time, do not put a politician as the chairman of the Federal Reserve. That should be separated out. And when we're talking about Janet Yellen, have you read much about her?
Oh, yes.
Have you read about her husband?
No.
Okay, good.
But that's different.
This is good, because she co-authored, or he authored and she co-authored, a paper in the 1970s. Her husband's name is George Akerlof, and he won the Nobel Prize for this paper. It's dealing with the labor market and inefficiencies in the labor market and what can lead to further unemployment and lesser unemployment. It led to the Nobel Prize because it was proven to be correct again and again and again since then. He's a professor at Berkeley. Janet Yellen was a professor and got her PhD at Yale. She's been on one of the board members of the Federal Reserve, one of the governors of the Federal Reserve, for a long time. Right now, she's number two. She is the academic thought leader on the Federal Reserve right now. She is brilliant. She co-authored a Nobel Prize-winning economics paper. The information from her is purely non-political. She speaks as a Federal Reserve board member should, which is to say, look at the data. Don't try to make some political statement with the data. Look at the data and make the decisions based on what you think the results will be, not on what political party will be pushed forward by it. Larry Summers, on the other hand, is the opposite. He wants to make political moves. Now, if Barack Obama is smart for his own political career and probably the political careers of other Democrats, and he's not thinking about the well-being of the country, he should nominate Larry Summers. If he really is what he claims to be, which is someone that is interested in the well-being of the country, he should nominate Janet Yellen.
So we have here a litmus test for
this is
the
it.
President.
Yeah, this is the one. I realize this falls well below the radar of most people that are out there purely in the conservative political arena. But this is one. This is the litmus test, because the difference between the two is politics, pure and simple.
And, well, there's more than politics involved in this. Larry Summers, very frankly, was one of the proponents of deregulation.
Yeah, he led to the Great Recession.
In the 1990s, and said basically derivatives like mortgage securities don't need any form of regulation, that the market will self-regulate.
He's been on record for that many times.
He was against the TARP program. He was and still is against stimulus in the form of QE.
QE, whatever number.
All the things that basically headed off the Great Depression from reoccurring, he has come out against. Now, that will make him loved by the Republicans, likely.
Right.
So if it's a political move,
it's a brilliant one for the Democrat Party.
It would be a brilliant move. Now, on the other hand, Janet Yellen is certainly not going to score any political points.
No.
Because she is so
bland,
apolitical.
She's bland. If you talk about, we're trying to find some
agenda,
kind of fiery rhetoric, you're not going to find it there. She's looking at data. She's an economist.
It'll be really interesting to see which way he goes on that. And I certainly hope he chooses for the sake of us and our clients and the
Janet
economy.
Yellen is the person.
Yeah.
If he's going to choose somebody,
okay,
she's the best one for the job.
And interestingly enough, I've read a little analysis on this. Janet Yellen will not get the warm reception that a politician will get, and I say politician, you know, you can't really call Larry Summers a politician because he's never elected.
No, but he's been politically oriented for most of his career.
Ideologically and politically aligned. It's going to be a very, that is the, arguably the second most powerful position on the planet is the chairperson of the Federal Reserve. And the president nominates, and the Senate will either confirm or reject. It will be, to me, a fascinating thing to see what happens. And if you are praying people, then I'll say pray for Janet Yellen for the sake of the United States. She is a competent professional.
Right. Larry Summers went from being Secretary of Treasury to the president of Harvard.
And then had to resign.
Right. Well, when you look through his record, he's been in administrative roles. He's been making non-economic-oriented decisions. The Secretary of the Treasury doesn't look at the economy. I realize that that's a strange thing for most people. He's in charge of the United States budget. He's checking to make sure that the money is being paid to the right people at the right time and that the right taxes are being collected, and that's his job. The Federal Reserve is not an administrative body as such. It does have some regulatory authority, but the Federal Reserve Board, the chairman himself or herself, the job is to look at the economic data, which is something that Yellen has been doing for all of her adult life and into her teenage years, where Summers has been...
Boy, are we geeky.
Oh, boy, are we.
We're going on and on about somebody that...
Most people out there are kind of going, I don't care. Don't really care.
And what they certainly have never heard of that person.
But it's a lot like the Nile water rights being the reason why Morsi is no longer president, and a lot like wheat prices being the reason why the Arab Spring actually took place, not democracy and freedom. That was something that came later. If you don't understand the driving forces underneath politics... then this is a non-event. Who cares who's the Federal Reserve Chair? If you understand what makes political decisions happen, I mean, when we talk about whether or not we should blame the president for bad economic times or give him credit for good economic times, our answer is almost unilaterally no. He has no impact on this. Well, this particular office that is being talked about right now, the Federal Reserve, has an impact, an immediate, vital impact on that. And that's why it needs to be non-political, because if you think back of all the flack that Ben Bernanke was getting during the Great Recession, when people were talking about how horribly he was doing and how they hated him, you don't hear that anymore. In fact, you hear the opposite about how well he is doing and how well he took us through that downturn, and nobody else could have done it. And that's a sign of, if it were a political situation and he were being governed by the opinion polls, he would have done something very, very different, and we would have gone through a depression. We probably would still be in the depression, and we probably would have a world war going on right now. This is not extreme. This is what happens in history. This has happened again and again and again in history. It's not something that I'm just making up on the fly.
I really think if anybody deserves the Nobel Peace Prize, it would be
Ben Bernanke.
Ben Bernanke.
Yes.
Well, the only other news that we haven't covered...
That
I have on my list here is the fact that one of the reasons, there's two events that are likely to come up in the near future, but one of the things that we're probably going to see is an upward revision in last quarter's GDP because of exports.
Yep.
A caller called in last hour about the fact that consumers are not buying as much, and that's true. I will completely concur. For instance, we're going to have a birthday party. We have three of our children who are going to have birth dates in August, and the consensus was not go out and buy something for them, but that the rest of us were supposed to find something that we had that we didn't want that we think they might want and give it to them. Now, that's an interesting concept, because I just heard the same thing in a church. Down in Austin, a big church down in Austin, apparently what they're doing now is you bring things in that you think are valuable, but you don't want anymore, and you put them in a given location, and then you put that there, and then you could go pick up something from somebody else that you want that they didn't want, serviceable items. That's an interesting concept. It's going on in society. We are going through a retrenchment. This is a situation where we normally would have been in severe deflation. We are in a form of deflation at this point. People are not spending as much money. They're saving money. They're still paying off debts. The United States government is busy winding its debt down. We're probably losing at least 1% a year of GDP because of a wind down in government spending.
I think it could be measured more in the 1.5 to nearer to 2.
And that is resulting in lower economic, that results in economic activity, fewer jobs, and we're at a delicate balance in that. Is that an accurate statement? Yes.
Absolutely.
It's everywhere. But we get through these things, and the efficiencies that we pick up along the way, the education we pick up along the way, and the reality check. People going to college today are far more likely to take courses that will lead to employment than they were just a few years ago.
Yeah, and it's really hard to cash reality checks, which is why they're doing that. They had the reality checks. Mm-hmm. You cannot cash them. You can't get a job as a basket weaver, no matter how well you do it.
You can
do it if you're a farmer's market job.
Right.
You could just set up with something.
You just can't make a living at it,
right.
That's all. Right.
If you spent 7 years in college to get your PhD in basket weaving, it's really hard to get a good job.
Right. That is a
reality check would not get cashed.
And so I think we're going through a very good retrenchment right now, very uncomfortable, but not as uncomfortable as it could be.
Right.
We are, every long-term economic indicator says we're going to come out of it and dominate the world in the 21st century. You think we're dominating the world today? It's nothing compared to what will happen over the next 10 to 20 years.
We're the ones that are retooling and retraining fastest. If you look around at what's going on in the rest of the world and how they're dealing with this, they're cutting back. They're pushing away from private business, and they're going back towards the governmental
right.
sector. We're doing the opposite.
With an exception. And that's what's known as the emerging markets, the
correct.
People who are coming out of socialism, in essence,
yep.
moving towards our model, buying things from us, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, and selling to us at the same time.
And so there's a couple of areas out there where there's some tremendous potential. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and we're going to be out of, if today is August 17th, we're going to be probably off and playing reruns for the next 2 weeks while we go on vacation.
Yeah, so we'll be playing it again in 2 weeks. We'll be this episode.
We still have an office, and we still have a voicemail or a telephone at 947-1111 locally.
You can reach it toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Or you can email us. Jeff@tpwc.com or Jake@tpwc.com, or you can go to our webpage, tpwc.com, and we'll be forwarding the personalwealthcoach.com to that address shortly as well.
And we'll be going out next couple of weeks and collecting lots of economic information.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And
stimulating the economy.
Right. Okay.
Yes.
We'll be back in a couple of weeks with the Personal Wealth Coach.
Balance, your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.